Pseudopod, episode 180, February 5th, 2010. This week's story, The Gasolong Gang, by Barry Dark. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, your weekly dose of all the best things from the dark side of the street. This week's story is provided by Barry Dark, whilst your narrator is the Dark Overlord himself, the man, the legend, the Benjamin, Mr. Ben Phillips. So without further ado, keep your face straight and do not react, however wrong the thing you notice is. Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Get-Along Gang, by Barry Dark. I kept an eye out all day at the office, so much so that I hardly got any work done myself. When you're the manager, it goes without saying, they think all you do anyway is watch over them and sit idle yourself, so I probably got away with it. By 10 a.m., actually, I knew it wasn't happening with anyone there. But I didn't relax, and I remained vigilant all the way through till 5:30 p.m. when the last of them left. There was Jerry's nervous giggle, of which he was oblivious, prefacing any comment he made of a non-work nature, Philippa's slight squaring of the shoulders whenever she got up from her desk to walk anywhere, elderly Molly's reddening neck whenever I spoke to her about anything, even the damp heat of unhappiness coming off old Ted like steam from a Vietnamese jungle. None of it snagged my attention in the wrong way. None of it jarred with me. So then I had to brace myself for going home. On the whole, this made me more sad and more frightened. I hadn't known which way they would go for sure, my feelings, but they came down to going that way, sad and frightened. Just one glimmer of it in another person would have been a relief of sorts. Of strange sorts, admittedly, but still a relief. At home, I kissed Emma on the cheek and rubbed the back of her neck, said I'd had a good day in general, and heard her say the same in a tone that meant she hadn't, and I'd be hearing more about it later. I went upstairs and spent 10 minutes with Sandy and Jonjo. The Lego was out in force. It was hard. One of my hardest evenings. It was hard to eat, hard to talk, hard to make it look as though I was listening to Emma and thinking about what I was supposed to be listening to. Because of my vigilant day, where I'd been fishing but catching nothing, I noticed it in shoals. Apologies for the indelicacy, but that's the least of my concerns if I want to be accurate about everything, and I think I have to be, as far as possible. It looks like it might be important. I first noticed it happening after sex. I had gone down on her, and there was something different about the sigh she gave at the end of her climax. It's an unguarded moment, if ever there was one, even in these circumstances, and I was still in a heightened state from my own, so maybe natural that it should happen then and be noticed happening. We'd been married for 7 years, and together for 2 before that. We probably had an average of 3 lovemaking bouts a week, and in that situation, you know every second of how it should be. You know when something's different, when someone's different. What it was there was a different catch in the sound of the happy, falling into relaxation sigh she gave as the orgasm sparks died out. It was an other kind of contentment, more fitting, I thought immediately, to finishing a fine meal. It was as though, again, I thought immediately, she'd forgotten the right orgasmic sound, or hadn't known it in the first place. This was the closest she could get to it. She wasn't faking it, if that's what you're thinking. Her stomach still vibrated in that unfakeable way. It happened again, exactly the same thing, a few days later. It was the same wrong sound, utterly unmistakable now. We'd made love once in between, and I hadn't noticed it then, so it hadn't happened. But here it was again. I almost said something that time, but I saw that my posture sitting up on the bed was pretty combative and stopped myself. It was late at night through the week, and there wasn't much time for talking before she dropped off. I suppose we did talk, though I haven't even the flimsiest recall of what I said, and couldn't begin to imagine it now. Sleep was impossible for me, of course. She lay on her side, turning over and back again regularly without waking. When she was facing me, I looked into her face in the dark. I try not to do this for too long or too intently in case it woke her up, but at the same time, it was hard not to. I looked at her freckles and moles, which I'd always told her looked like they'd been designed and positioned for maximum aesthetic pleasure. I wanted to touch her, but didn't want to wake her. It got lighter eventually, so then I had to pretend to be asleep myself. Like anyone would, I tried to ignore it. But that was like saying to someone, for the next 10 seconds, try not to think of a pink hippo. I couldn't do it, even in the early days when the signs were fairly weak and intermittent, and I didn't really know what to make of them. It was faint information that my brain wasn't ready for, but I couldn't turn away from it. In fact, their faintness made sure I was even more alert to catching them. It was in the sound of the plates hitting the dining table with a different kind of force. The wrong strands of hair falling over her ears. The placement of her fingers along the knife and fork. All the things only someone intimate would know. That's the big insult, isn't it? Someone, presumably not a sentimentalist, said that "remember when" was the lowest form of conversation. It was all I could think of to do, though. Emma liked that talk once in a while of how we first met. She'd been the friend of someone I worked with when I was working my way up. It was this friend's birthday pub crawl. Sandy and Jonjo were in the yard when I brought this up, and it was still strange to me talking of a time when they didn't exist. They couldn't understand it themselves, and when they saw pictures of our wedding, they said they must have been staying with the babysitter. She remembered what I was wearing then, which was my 50s-style rockabilly shirt. Don't ask. It's long been consigned to the unrespectable part of the wardrobe. And how I'd been paranoid about getting any spills on it, so she'd kept dipping a fingertip into her drink and threatening to flick it at me. The shirt was in red and black, she recalled dreamily. I looked half daft and half good in it, she thought, then and now. I wanted that to be enough. But such a conversation led directly to her being in a romantic mood. Once the children were asleep, we went up. But something about the way she dropped her bra, the way it lay on the floor in an unusual pattern, unnerved me, and I couldn't get anywhere. I really wanted to. I had the idea that lovemaking started this, but could also blow away some of the tremors. But it wasn't ever going to happen that night, and I had the feeling it would be difficult from then on. This kind of letdown usually happened no more than 3 or 4 times a year, and that was the second time that year. We were in late May, so it was more or less all right. She said all the kindly things. I felt like weeping and endured another sleepless night. We lived in a different city from both sets of parents. Hers came to visit and were visited more than mine, and they came during this time. Usually, I admit, I found them a trial over anything longer than an hour and a half. But I was glad that day to see them bumbling along the path in that fussy way they had. I felt sure they would divine something was wrong within 5 seconds, perhaps even the instant she opened the door to them. They would know. And even if they pretended not to know, I would see it in their faces. So when they came through, they probably saw something in me they'd never seen before. We'll call it mute pleading. The short version, in case you're on tenterhooks, is that nothing happened. After the usual 90 minutes, I was foot-tappingly impatient for them to make the journey back to their car. Parents, we can conclude, especially when it came to those of adults, were masters of seeing only what they wanted to see and telling themselves things based on that. If I tried to nudge them into that arena by wondering if Emma seemed okay to them, they would either have no clue what I was talking about, or they would turn in and talk about it between themselves, so I passed over that particular pleasure, thank you very much. I thought of taking Emma and the children on an impromptu visit to my parents, but presumably they would see too easily what I wanted them to see, and that would be equally useless. I was also waiting for Sandy and Jonjo to come to me with their concerns. Whatever plan was taking place, it couldn't allow for the perceptions of children, surely. Children are still half resident in whatever realm the soul comes from. They can see ghosts. Underpasses remind them of the womb, and some of them have clearly been here before. I looked for them to be shying away from Emma, even if only on the unconscious level. I looked for them to keep their eyes on her, wonderingly, when she put them down after a cuddle and walked away. One rainy Saturday, while Emma was shopping for bargains with friends, I asked the children to draw a picture of her for when she got back. My voice shook when I asked them, and so did my hands when I picked up their work. I stared hard and frowningly, but both pictures were comically inconclusive. I had to refrain from asking questions about them and their arcane symbolism, and when Emma came in, they bundled into the bags to hug her. There was, of course, a good reason for this, as I came to see not long after. It was in the too patient way they started playing, together and apart. It was in the way Sandy straightened her dress on getting up off the floor. It was in the way, out of nowhere, Jonjo asked if we could get a dog. It was in the way he pronounced the word dog. That was when I looked for it in the people at work and didn't find it. It occurred to me later that week that maybe, just perhaps, it was happening to the other family men in the office, that they were also noticing these things about their families. Thomas Malone, only in his early 20s but with two young boys, looked harried a lot of the time, and I thought about taking him out for a drink after work one day. But how do you go about broaching that subject? How many drinks would you need in you to mention you thought your family had been... And what would happen to you if you got back looks that moved from the merely quizzical to the horribly worried? The whole idea of it happening elsewhere to other people was still hazy at that point anyway, so I thought I'd better let him come to me. I was an approachable boss, after all. At home, it was how I imagined living in a haunted house must be. You moved in dread of every little awry sign, trying to convince yourself that the gaps between them were widening rather than shortening, accelerating. And that if the signs were there, then they really weren't growing any more significant. They really weren't becoming bone-rattlingly critical. It was actually very hard to go home. I wanted nothing more than to work late, even if it was just shuffling papers, then hit the pub for a few hours, even if I was in there with rowdy young boys and girls. I saw myself finding refuge in cinemas on my own, though I was never what you'd call a movie buff or even much of a fan. I couldn't do any of these things, clearly. I had to stick to my routines. It was probably best not to arouse any suspicions, just in case. I didn't know exactly what would happen to me if I did arouse any suspicions, but I could predict it was a thing I would regret. So I went home, sighed and flopped theatrically in the chair after my busy day, told anecdotes, jokes. I tried to listen for whatever was under anything they said to me, because I was doing two things here, and God forgive me for saying so, but they both seemed of equal importance at the time. The first was trying to work out what the plan was and who was planning it. I had settled by now on the fact that this was probably just happening to me for now, happening to me first. They were good, so this was always going to be a matter of intuition, though intuition was something they couldn't take away from you. You run through the options, however extreme some of them might be, and whichever strikes you as the worst, whichever makes you drop to Stalingrad temperatures in the chest, that's the most likely one, isn't it? I went through some far-fetched options at first, such as, I was watching the skies, you know? I thought that old film had just been a way of preparing us, me, for this. Who else would have the technology needed to do it? I kept an eye out for missing pieces of time, for indents in the yard, for things left lying around that had no earthly origin. Demons, that was another thing that occurred to me. We didn't have a family Bible or anything like that, so I spent a while in the library flipping through the back pages of one of them, but couldn't be sure, despite all the hair-raising stuff in there. I kept up my scrutiny of the pictures the children drew, the stories they wrote, to see if there were any winged things, any representation of flames and so on, but there weren't. So that's when I narrowed it down to the government. The world government, for want of a better term. I'm not saying the Jews, I'm saying the rich. It's hard to believe in aliens or demons. They're not really needed when humans with money and power are around. Humans can open up all the chasms of evil you could possibly want. Why they were doing it, I didn't know for a while. But these things can be worked out without too much difficulty. They're not so mysterious. Rolled out over a long period of time, this plan would lead to a controlled society. A controlled society is a productive society, and a productive society benefits the ones who are, as it were, controlling the controls. No crime, no family traumas to stir up the brewing trouble pots and the future workers, just seamless, ceaseless wealth creation for the elite and everyone playing happy families. The second thing I was doing was mourning my family. This was something else I couldn't hide from myself. A plan as audacious as this would have to be ruthlessly implemented. There wasn't room on the planet for two of everyone, and frankly no need for them. It was as simple and straightforward as that. So they had been taken. Probably in broad daylight, while I was daydreaming at the office, taken and wired up to some new invention. Who needed alien technology nowadays? It was all alien. That would input their memories and emotional responses into some kind of bank, and then they could be gotten rid of. I believe that's the euphemism government departments use, gotten rid of. All a minor question of a bullet, a bag, a ditch. The heartbreaking thing was that they still occupied the same space next to me, if you know what I mean. If you're standing in a pub and a friend you haven't seen for years, but always used to go out for a drink with, comes in and stands next to you, you can feel it's them before you even turn around to make sure. You know their mass, the rhythms they're pushing out. That never changed with Emma and the children either. It was their masterstroke getting that right. They almost had to have some of their own humanity left to have thought of that. Whether in lines at the supermarket, chasing them in the park, or swaying slightly drunk in the back of a cab, it always felt like them, like her. Soon, though, that was almost the only time it felt like that. And even then, I still knew it wasn't. I kept going for a while. You never know how your strengths are going to expand to cope with what's in front of you. This is one thing that governments, in all their vanity, fail to understand, that it can be our hatred of them that keeps us moving forward despite all the injuries they inflict on us. I had my tears, of course I did. I had those moments where I was sure I was going to simply dissolve. Of course I did. Crying in the bath was always the worst. I had the radio on, the door locked, and I could sob and put water over my face and slip under the water if I wanted to. But I kept going, and after a while I was getting there. I'm not Superman, I'm every man, going through something I had no experience of, with nothing to refer to. Soon the crying stopped. Then I was just a little quiet, a touch inner-directed. It's not a crime, but it wasn't like me. And it prompted Emma to say one night, "What's the matter, Danny? You don't seem yourself these days." The look I must have given her then. I managed to make it seem as though amusement predominated. Amusement and naked astonishment aren't too far apart if you're quick, ready. And it's true that I nearly laughed at the sheer malicious nerve of it. The things these people believe they can get away with. Sometimes the only response is to bray despairing laughter into their faces. Instead of doing that, I shrugged, nodded, admitted there was a pressure horizon at work. Never before had I used a term like that, but it was one that Emma accepted, that seemed to make sense to her. She thought the best way to deal with it was a few glasses of wine once the children were in bed, and an early night for us. She wanted to take me in her mouth. I even failed at that, very much so. It couldn't be helped, turning that line of hers over and over in my mind all that sleepless night and the next bedraggled day at work, where they probably thought I wanted them to pity me, snowed under with my concerns. It went beyond nerve, that line. It was almost a slip-up on their behalf, which still left the question of what to do about it. I took the afternoon off, tried to eat a sandwich on a park bench, but kept drifting off between bites, forgetting even to chew sometimes before I threw it in the trash. Then I texted Emma, just before I knew she left the house, to say I would pick Jonjo up from the nursery. She said that would be great, and sounded like she meant it. I wondered if it would be causing any consternation in any of their nerve centers. They would have code names for this, and code names for what to do about it, even if I hadn't left them much time. Nothing much needed to be said to the other parents, mostly mothers, at the gates. We didn't know each other very well, and they had their own conversations to be getting on with. I kept checking my watch, certain that some kind of call had been made to secure the premises. But then a barely heard bell rang, and they soon came tumbling out on their treacherous legs, jackets flapping and hair a mess. John Joe had done a picture of a golden dog. It went on the back seat of the car. He sat in the front, and we were on our way. I took him back to the park. They wouldn't be expecting a public place. I told him there would be people walking dogs there, as if he needed an incentive. I held his hand as we took a slow walk through. There were people around, though not many with dogs, but that was all right. We were talking about his day, the people in his class, our plans for the evening, what would be for dinner. Then I started to slip a few in. The first time, I thought a heart attack would barrel forward, knock me flat on my back, but I got through it. "So where's the real you buried?" I asked him. He looked up at me with his smile for adults who said things he didn't understand. "Who did he call Al for last? Was it me or her?" He started burbling on about dogs and his favorite dog names. "You must be lonely, though. There's Sandy, I know, but you must want someone your own age." Dog names had to be different from human names, though it could be funny if they had human names, and they definitely had to be different from cat names. "How long is it going to take? You'll be a grown man, I suppose, before the whole world's running the way they want it to. Might even have some kind of family of your own." He moved on from dog names to sweets and his favorite food, and how maybe on his birthday he'd be allowed to mix the two together. "If you're listening, I know. I've known for weeks now. I'm gonna snap this one's neck. You can come and get me if you want. You know where I live. Just get there before I lock the doors and burn it down." He was talking about clouds now, and he never could get it fixed in his mind that clouds were water. I picked him up. I was almost shaking him. I wanted him to say he loved me so I could believe it. We got looks off people, but I couldn't care about that. After a while, when he still hadn't said it, I put him down and we went back to the car. I drove us around at random for a while, until I started getting text messages from Emma wondering where we were, telling me what time dinner would be ready, so get your skates on. Eventually, I headed us that way. The street was calm, if not quiet, when we turned in. No one was around that I didn't know, at least by sight, if not by name. I carried John Joe inside, even though he didn't like that much now, but I wanted one of them with me at first. Sandy was throwing a tennis ball off the passage wall and catching it more times than not, an advance for her. She barely looked at us, such was her concentration. Emma was in the kitchen, keeping the tea from being over ready. There was a flicker of concern on her face, but it was the old kind of maternal concern that something might be wrong with John Joe, not with me. She asked if everything was all right, and I said of course it was. I just wanted an afternoon off to clear out my head. I kissed her on the cheek, swung John Joe around for one as well, then I put him down. I was feeling prickles between my shoulder blades for a few hours, but I managed to eat most of my dinner. Then we sat in front of the TV news, none of which I took in. I knew if measures were to be taken against me, it would probably be Sandy pointing the gun or jabbing the knife for that extra precious second of stunned, immobile disbelief she would need. In the middle of the night, something broke in me. You can call it a break. I caved in. I went through to the bathroom, sat on the edge of the bath, and cried my eyes out, as we used to say. I had had enough now, all at once. I just wanted this to be livable. I had to find a way to make it livable. I walked around the quiet house, looked out into the quiet street, the lightening sky. Then I went back to bed. That night, believe it or not, I slept the best I had since all this began. and in the morning, my smile felt like it fitted my face properly. It reached my eyes, I was sure of it. They can come and take me when they want, but I will have good, final memories for them. Whoever gets them will be pleased with them, these memories I have planned. Now, we do more things than ever before. Our love life, for a start, is a thing of wonders, of planet-struck miracles. I said to Emma that Sandy and John Joe might like to see our honeymoon spot in the north of France, and we agreed to go there for Christmas and the New Year. We talk more and more intently about the past and the future. We tell jokes. I still notice these quirks, but I find them livable now. It's surprising what you can learn to live with when you put your mind to it. So that's us. We're the get-along gang. And this is our dog.
As the Talking Heads once put it, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. Everyone's had that moment of absolute self, absolute nothing, when you are suddenly very aware that you're looking out at the world through cameras made largely of water, that life is completely bizarre, totally impossible, and happening at you all the time. Or that might just be me. Assuming that it isn't, and I'm not in fact horrifically alone in this, that moment of self, that moment where you see the whole picture, is something that authors have been fascinated by and discussed for years. Nietzsche, Douglas Adams, and many more have all talked about it or explored it. Barry does too, but takes a unique approach in doing so. You see here, it's all in the details. The details that help you draw your daily map. The details that tell you if you're in trouble, if you're happy, if you made a connection or made an enemy or just made dinner. Life is a fragile tapestry of choices and decisions, perceptions and assumptions, and it's all too easy to lose your focus and find yourself looking at the wrong piece. It's much harder, though not impossible, to be hired by an elite order of assassins who read the threads of fate and kill people who'll do awful things if you let them live. I'm not bothered though, their dental plan's lousy. So, pay attention to the big picture and try not to focus on the threads, because in the end that's really all we can do. Things will change, patterns will shift, and you either need to roll with that or be prepared for Morgan Freeman to put out a hit on you. And frankly, who wants that? Pseudopod is powered by love. Love is powered by money. Money is powered by hate. Hate leads to fear. Fear leads to... I'll try that again. Pseudopod is powered entirely by your donations. You pay our server costs, you pay our authors, so if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you, every single cent is appreciated. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod would have taken the midnight train going anywhere, but it turns out it doesn't have Wi-Fi. We'll see you next week for Spirit of Nationalism by Richard Marsden.